Welcome to the Political Cesspool, known worldwide as the South's foremost populist radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Welcome back to the second hour of tonight's live installment of the Political Cesspool radio program. I'm your host, James Edwards. Second hour. It's March 28th. Winston Smith in the studio with me tonight. We are going to get back on that which I was going to hit on a few minutes ago about how radical left liberalism is now the new so-called conservatism. A little later on in the program tonight, we got a great deluge of callers coming in, and we wanted to work those in. So we'll get back. We plenty more time for the fodder, but now it's my pleasure to introduce our first featured guest for the evening. Don't forget Ed Steele, still coming up in the third hour, a little bit later on this evening. But on the line now, from Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Greg Johnson. Dr. Johnson is the editor of the Occidental Quarterly, which is, of course, a journal of Western perspectives on man, culture, and politics, which is now, I'm proud to say, in its ninth year of publication. We had the honor of hosting Greg Johnson and Sam Dixon here in Memphis a few days ago for a private reception that was sponsored by this program, and it's great to be talking with Greg again tonight. And, of course, listeners of this program are going to be aware that quite a few of the contributors to the Occidental Quarterly, some of its authors, are very well-received guests on this program, Professor Kevin McDonald, Dr. F. Roger Devlin, and Dr. Virginia Abernathy being among them. All that being said, Greg, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks, James. It's an honor to be on.
Well, I don't know what took us this long to get it done. We should have you on quite a long time ago, but I'm glad we can make amends for that tonight. Greg, first of all, first question right out of the gate this evening. I get a lot of emails, a lot of phone calls from people saying, listen, it is too late to talk about the problems. We have got to take action. We have got to storm the castle. We've got to lift up the drawbridge and go out there with pitchforks, as Pat Buchanan would say. But you have devoted your energy and efforts in service of this movement to editing a journal of ideas. Why a journal of ideas, Greg?
Well, I would like to be out there with the pitchforks and the rifles myself, and I oftentimes find myself wondering what's the point of talking about the history of ideas like we do in the journal. But I have to remind myself that it's bad ideas that have gotten us in the present situation, and it's only going to be better ideas that are going to guide us out. I received last month an email. It was an Atlanta news article about a woman doctor who had been recently murdered in Midtown Atlanta. And I was reading through it, and I thought, this is the best advertisement for a journal like the Occidental Quarterly, because this woman is dead because of the power of bad ideas. Just to relate the story briefly, this woman was a doctor. She was an epidemiologist. She was a cancer researcher, highly intelligent, obviously, highly educated, and made a great contribution to society. It didn't indicate that she had ever been married or had a family. It did indicate that she had just retired, and after her retirement, she was planning on getting married and moving in with her fiancé. So right then and there, you have to ask yourself, how much did this lady buy into feminism, which is certainly one of the most powerful set of bad ideas that are floating around in our society today. And feminism is one of the dragons that we take on at the Occidental Quarterly. F. Roger Devlin has done some really amazing writing on that. And this poor woman's death came about as follows. She was out walking her poodle, and she came back to the condo building and found a 22-year-old black man named Shamal Thompson in the lobby. And Shamal, who had just finished eating at the Checkers down the street, had wandered into her building full of multi-million-dollar condos, pretending like he was going to buy one. And this fellow had a long record of criminal activities. He had been sentenced only recently to 10 years in jail and had only served 3 months before he had been released. There are a lot of bad ideas, obviously, went into the fact that he was still on the street. And in any case, to make a long story short, she had a condo up for sale, and he wanted to see it. And the security guard said, "Well, do you want me to accompany you up there?" And she said, "Oh no, we don't want to make Shamal think that we don't trust him." And once Shamal got inside the condo, he killed her and stole her diamond ring and $68 and left. And that was the end of this woman's life. Now, you know, if we sit down and dissect all the bad ideas that caused her death, feminism and racial egalitarianism being the big ones, the whole white guilt complex that she was obviously carrying around that made her want to go the extra mile, even at the cost of her own personal safety, to show that she trusted this guy, that she was going to reach out that hand of trust. All of these things are things that the Journal has been combating. We've been looking at the roots of those ideas. We've been looking at the consequences, and we've been trying to supply better ideas. So imagine this woman's life, or this woman's sad death, multiplied by millions. She's only one of many victims of the egalitarian ideas that are running our society into the ground. And you realize that we have to fight both in politics and in the political arena, but also in the arena of ideas. And so that's why we have a journal called the Occidental Quarterly.
Well, and it's not just a journal. I think it is the premier journal when you want to get down to the issues that matter. There is no journal that is more well-written. And Greg, I must say, your answer has absolutely exceeded expectations. Marvelous, marvelously worded answer, and I think that should give pause to a lot of these people. And listen, it's important to go out to the streets and campaign and canvass and do all of the things that you can do physically, but it's also good to exercise your brain power as well and combat some of those bad ideas that are really running this nation, down the proverbial cesspool, as it were. Winston, I want to give you an opportunity to ask a question of Dr. Johnson, because I know he's a man who, an English major and a literary giant such as yourself, you take a lot of... You think highly of him.
Oh, I certainly do. It was my pleasure to meet you, Greg, at the reception we had here, and I've been enjoying the Occidental Quarterly, the edition that you gave me. I especially liked your review of Craig Boddicker's A Conversation About Race, and Roger Devlin's review of Solzhenitsyn's last work. When I looked inside the cover of the Occidental Quarterly, I see the contributors, the authors, and there are more degrees there than a red-hot thermometer. So I expected a certain level of quality, but this is one of the most readable tomes that I have come across in a long time. Can I ask how the Occidental Quarterly got started? A lot of people don't know about it, and we'd like to know more about how you got started and...
Okay, well, I came into the Journal only a couple of years ago after it had been going for some time. But my understanding of the ancient history is this. In the year 2000, four people got together. They were Sam Francis, the late Sam Francis, the author and commentator,
mm-hmm.
Kevin Lamb, who was the first editor of the Occidental Quarterly, Louis Andrews, who is a marvelous fellow, a longtime activist, and Bill Regnery, who was the one of the early people involved in getting it published. And they decided that the time had come for a theoretical journal that would deal with the bad ideas, again, that are really poisoning our society. And they set some parameters that were, I think, really important. And the most important thing is, in my view, is this. Not only does the Occidental Quarterly talk about race and intelligence and science, it goes beyond that. It talks about culture. And one of the things that they very much wanted to be a part of the discussion is the role of the organized Jewish community in bringing about multiculturalism and other things that have led to America's decline. That is one of the things that sets TOQ off from other publications that I think are of high quality.
Greg,
in the
Greg, set tight.
Movement,
I hate
like
to interrupt. We're coming up on a commercial break. We're going to pick it up right there when we come back on the other side with the origins of the Occidental Quarterly and where we go from here, where the journal itself goes from here. When we return to the political cesspool with our first guest of the evening, Dr. Greg Johnson. Sit tight, everybody. You don't want to miss this.
Don't go away. The political cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Please understand me, baby.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't misunderstand.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Thank you, Art Frith, and welcome back to the show, everyone. Continuing on with our interview with Dr. Greg Johnson, editor of the Occidental Quarterly Journal. And Greg, We've had a few emails come in advance of your appearance tonight from listeners who are anticipating tonight's show, and we're going to get to a couple of those tonight if we have time. But first of all, I understand Winston would like to dive back into the conversation with another question for you. Winston?
Yes, Greg. When I met you at the reception, I can't remember if it was you or Sam Dixon who made the statement recalling a meeting that Vladimir Lenin, the Marxist, had with his followers, his 12 followers. And at this meeting, there were only 12 of them there. And he said, there are 12 of us here, and the world is ours. Now, our enemies are completely possessed of certain notions, certain ideas that they regard as absolute, ironclad truths. And they act on those ideas. Anything outside their ideas is illegitimate and hostile and has to be supplanted and destroyed. These people are animated by their ideas. What is it about white people that we will not allow ourselves to be animated in opposition to people who claim that the place we occupy is in fact their rightful place?
I was the guy who quoted Lenin there, and the reason I quoted it was I have to admire the guy's will to power. He walked into a room and sized it up and didn't see much there, a few people there, a small group, certainly not enough to storm the Winter Palace or seize control of the Russian Empire with. But instead of being a realist and moping around and saying, you know, well, we really need to work to get more people here, he looked around the room and he said, there are 12 of us. The world is ours. And he knew that the longest journey begins with a single step. And, if you have the will and the determination and the sense of purpose, it is really possible for very small groups of people to change the world. And Lenin is an example of that. And, of course, there would have been no Lenin had there not been a Marx. I guess the question boils down to why are people in America so seldom moved by ideas? And my answer to that is this. Americans are moved by ideas. They just don't know they are. Everybody is moved by ideas, even people who don't read books. They watch the television, they read the newspaper maybe, they get ideas spoon-fed to them, or just sort of ideas seep into their consciousness from the culture around them, and they're pretty much helpless because of this, because they have uncritically accepted a philosophy that's been foisted on them by other people, and the danger is that that philosophy that they accept might be designed by people to destroy them. And that is what I believe is the case about the reigning ideologies of multiculturalism, multiracialism, and so forth. I think these are ideas that are designed to destroy us as a people, And I see a lot of young people who, genetically speaking, are certainly handsome specimens of the white race, you know, who have got high IQs, but who have accepted because it's cool or because it's chic or because their teachers tell them it's true, ideas that if they consistently practice them, they will be destroyed as a people, not now. But in generations down the line, as our population dwindles and as our borders remain open to faster breeding people who are stampeding in to take this country away from us, we are going to reach a point of demographic collapse, and there will be no more white people on the North American continent, except for a few stubborn little groups that refuse to mix. So anyway, I guess my answer is, Americans, like everybody else in the world, are influenced by ideas, but Americans think that they're free of that, and that makes them real suckers, actually, in accepting bad ideas from the culture around them in the form of pop songs and TV shows and movies and so forth.
Greg, you're talking about bad ideas, and once again, I appreciate your last answer. Of course, we're told that any European Americans who are concerned about the prevailing trends are, in fact, evil people, which is absolutely apocryphal and a vicious lie, in fact. I mean, this is what we're here to do. The way you're articulating these issues tonight, Greg, is what this show is all about. But you're talking about bad ideas, getting back to bad ideas. Bad ideas, though, are certainly able to bear fruit, and we see that now with the Obama presidency, and I'm going to open up a Pandora's box. I know there's many different avenues you could take with this question, but just kind of put it in a nutshell if you can. What is your take on the Obama presidency? Do you think this is a good thing or a bad thing for whites in this country?
In a way, I think it's a good thing if we make it a good thing, and it's a bad thing if we let it be a bad thing. And the onus, again, is on us. I want us all to be like Lenin when he walked into that room and saw that little crowd and said, okay, well, we're going to start small and we're going to win the world. The Obama presidency is obviously a reason for a lot of people to think that it's over. It's a ghastly, absurd spectacle that this man has been elected president of the United States, and we're rapidly discovering that he is another black empty suit, dependent on teleprompters, and I think we're in for 4 or 8 years of Saturday Night Live, and it would be funny if so many serious things weren't at stake. That said, I think Obama's election is probably a good thing for white people if we get the word out, and it presents us with this opportunity. America has not been our country for a long time. Okay? America has not been a country ruled by and for the interests of the white majority that created this country. America's government has been captured a long time ago by a coalition of people that includes sort of rootless plutocrats, you know, rich people who have no connection really to their people and their land. There's a significant number of highly ethnocentric Jews in the establishment. And then there's a part of the coalition consists of minority groups who are rapidly becoming the majority, blacks, non-whites of all sorts, disgruntled and alienated people, feminists, homosexuals, people like that. Those people control our country. It's not our country anymore. And it doesn't matter whether there's a Republican in the White House or a Democrat in the White House. The same policies are basically being pursued, and the same people are ruling this country in their interests, not our interests, and they're running this country into the ground. If John McCain had gotten elected, the same bad things that are happening would continue to happen. And in fact, he would be going out of his way to show that just because he's a white guy, he's not a racist. And he'd probably be pandering more shamelessly to minorities than Obama is. The trouble with McCain is this. He would have put a white face, a white male face, on a system that's out to get white people, and especially white males. And given how superficial most people's understanding of the world is, if they see a white guy in the White House, that to them means that this is still their country. Okay.
Greg, if you don't mind, sorry to interrupt once again. Commercial break coming up. We're going to let you pick up that thought, as always, on the flip side. So sit tight, everyone, listening around the country tonight. The Political Cesspool will continue with James Edwards and Winston Smith and our guest Greg Johnson right after these words from our sponsors.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. We gotta
get out of this place. I tell you, this is an absolute vortex here in the political cesspool. I don't know where the time goes. It's already fleeting, that time which we have available with Greg Johnson tonight. Greg, you were talking about, and you made an excellent point. Obviously, there really is no difference when it comes down to the intangibles that we need, whether or not Obama or McCain would have won last year. I think, though, in some ways, maybe it could be a stark awakening for our folks to see just the visual impact of having a guy like Obama in there. But it certainly, I don't think we would have been any better off with McCain. And I think that was the point you were making far more eloquently than myself. But, Greg, we've got a couple of callers on the line for you, and also a few questions that I'd like to try to get to from the mailbag, and one in particular comes from a new political cesspool listener in Oklahoma, but he's been a 3-year subscriber to the Occidental Quarterly, and this is what he writes, and it's directed to you, Greg. As a member of the Libertarian Party, I got fed up with their dismal record on ethnic issues, even though 90% of the members were white, like me. To not admit that it was an ethnically white movement seemed like a glaring act of cowardice. From that, I found out about paleoconservatism. This led me to Kevin McDonald's writings, which I became fascinated with and still am to this day. From being an avid reader of the Occidental Quarterly, I came to learn about the European New Right, with Dr. Tomislav Sunik being a great example. This leads me to my question. Do you believe that there is any way the two can combine and become a more effective worldwide advocacy group for the European diaspora? I guess, Greg, the question is, can American paleoconservatives join with the European New Right to form some sort of a coalition?
Well, yes and no. The European New Right is a very vital movement, and yet it is European. It's in some ways not for export. I think, though, that we can definitely in the United States be inspired by a lot of the ideas and thinkers of the European New Right, and come up with something of our own that's more suited to the United States and its history. I also want to say something about libertarianism. When I was first attracted to political ideas, I was a teenager, libertarianism was very attractive to me. And, you know, deep down inside, I am an individualist, but that is the great gulf between libertarianism and any kind of racialism. Libertarians are dyed-in-the-wool individualists, and therefore there are no groups that matter, it's just individuals, even though libertarianism is the kind of idea that only white people really get excited by. And my point I would make to libertarian individualists is simply this. Libertarianism presupposes, if it's going to function, some kind of collectivism, and by that I simply mean this. It presupposes that you've already got a society where the people are basically free, white, and 21, that they're not having to compete in day-to-day life or for political power with people who don't accept their same individualistic premises. But if you are in a multicultural society like the one we're in, being an individualist puts you at a systematic disadvantage in dealing with other people, people who are collectivist, group-oriented. when the individualist when a person who's a member of a collective group, collective-minded group, comes to the individualist and says, "I want something from you," the individualist has to say, "Well, you know, objectively, this guy is better than my cousin, you know, John, and so I guess I got to give the job to this guy rather than to my cousin John." If you go to a member of a similar group and ask them for something, ask them to hire your cousin John, it doesn't matter how good your cousin John is, he's a member of the out group, and they're going to hire one of their own. Now, what this means is that over time, individualists lose power. They lose power even in the societies that they create, because they are not effective at maintaining their power and their wealth again in group-wise competition with collectivist-minded people. So, libertarianism and individualism only really works if you've already got a racially and culturally homogenous group of white people practicing it. As soon as you open the doors to different groups, libertarianism and individualism are slowly going to be ground out, and basically they're going to become extinct. So I'm glad to hear that another person has come up from libertarianism to a more racial nationalist point of view. I think a lot of people have made that journey, and one of the things I'm going to have in a future issue of the Occidental Quarterly is a whole issue about this. For me, the thing that really brought me along towards a racial nationalist outlook was simply the fact that, because I didn't believe in anything collective at the time, I had absolutely no susceptibility to collective racial guilt when that was being thrown at me by the media and by educators in college and high school and so forth. That meant nothing to me. And I think that because I was immunized against that kind of white guilt by my libertarian individualism, I was later able to grow into a more collectivist racial nationalist outlook.
Greg, we only have a couple of minutes until our next break, but I want to go to the phones very quickly. Mike in Tennessee, you're on the political cesspool. Go ahead, Mike.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the line.
Hey, good afternoon, or good evening now.
Good evening. What can we do for you this evening?
Well, I was listening to you early on in the 6 o'clock hour, and you were talking about the newspaper in Memphis that's slowly turning the lights out, and you also mentioned that you went to Chuckalissa Indian Village today, and I'm quite familiar with that. And then you made a comment that about the only, I guess, significant attributing factor was that they figured out how to build a mound and use so many pails of dirt. But is that the only thing you learned from the visit down there?
Well, I learned that they don't have enough money to upkeep it because they used to have some huts there, and now if you've been lately, it's just some grassy fields. Now, I was being a little bit in jest there. I mean, it's okay. You know, I've gone to Chuckalissa a lot. I used to go with my grandfather, and I just went out there today. Little tongue-in-cheek thing. I think it's a nice little museum.
Well, it is, in fact. It's an archaeologist, you know the word, archaeologist site.
Right.
And that is a burial mound, actually. And, of course, being of Native American descent, I've been studying my own ancestry as much as I'm sure you can appreciate yours. And the fact, if you look at the Constitution and the fact that the Iroquois and the contribution to the founding fathers and the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness issues and the freedom of religion are directly attributed to the Iroquois. And most people don't know that, but that's where that comes from. And certainly the Cherokee had their own newspaper, the Phoenix, back in the early 1820s, and certainly it was the Europeans who came in and destroyed that newspaper when they started putting out information about the government trying to come in, the state of Georgia trying to come in and take over the land. And, of course, they had a subscription worldwide. It went into Europe as well as all over the United States. So,
well, Mike, I appreciate you taking advantage of honoring your cultural heritage. That's something we could all agree on. I don't know about the other stuff, but call back in the third hour. We've got a guest on right now. We're trying to stay on topic, but I do appreciate you taking the time to phone us this evening in the political cesspool. Greg, getting back on topic here, I know you wrote an opinion piece on the proposed bailouts of the automotive industry for the Occidental Quarterly. What's your take on that and on the current economic crisis in general?
Well, the bailout has become multiple bailouts now. And the reason why that's happened is simply this. The U.S. automotive industry is in trouble because they cannot compete with foreign-made cars. And, you know, extending them loans is really not a way of dealing with the underlying problem with the industry, which is their lack of competitiveness with foreign imports. And the suggestion I made was simply this: instead of keeping, instead of bailing out a sinking ship constantly, let's look for the hole in the hull. And the hole in the hull really is free trade. If you want to put it that way. The United States grew to a very powerful and wealthy society because it, throughout most of its history, it practiced protectionism. It put tariffs on imported manufactured goods, and that allowed industries in the United States to grow large and strong. And I think we need to really revisit that that outlook. And so that's what I suggested. In terms of the broader economic crisis, again, what happens with this crisis is really to a large matter what make of it. We can go around muttering gloomily that the end is near, or we can take this as an opportunity.
Hey, Greg, once again, it's time for a commercial break. Sorry to interrupt one more time.
Sure.
We're going to take that break. We're going to come back and let you pick up right there on the bailout.
All right.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We got to get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we got to get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life.
Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Greg, it looks as though we're just going to have you back on the program. Not enough time tonight to get into everything I wanted to mention, but I want to give you the opportunity to continue your thoughts on the automotive bailout and the economic crisis in general, which you were making just before the break. I want to give Winston a chance to get another question in before we get some contact information for those wanting to subscribe to the Occidental Quarterly. Take it away, Greg.
Okay, well, what I was saying about the present economy is this. Again, it's an objective situation. We can treat it as an opportunity or we can treat it as a stumbling block. I prefer to treat it as an opportunity. It has been a cliche in the racialist movement for decades now that nobody's going to listen to us until the proverbial balloon goes up, until America's economy isn't functioning very well. And that looks like it's happening. It looks like we're coming up on a depression that's going to be as great as the Great Depression. And we aren't ready for all the gloom and doom talk about how people won't listen until there's an economic crisis. Very few people have been creating the infrastructure to get the word out to people, and I congratulate you for doing that. You've been doing that. The Journal has been around. We're entering our ninth year. American Renaissance is going strong. But there are precious few publications and organizations out there to really get the word out now that people are more inclined to listen than ever before. There's no use crying over spilled milk, but what we do need to do is we need to take full advantage of this opportunity. And that means we need to build our infrastructure and our organizations. People need to donate to the political cesspool to help you reach a greater audience. People need to subscribe to the Occidental Quarterly. People need to subscribe to American Renaissance. And we have to remember one thing. We're not an opposition if we only do well when the system is doing well, and when the system begins to stumble, we stumble along with them. That means that we're just an ineffectual opposition. A real opposition would respond to this like the communists did after the 1929 crash. They didn't fold up their tent and their activities and wait until the economy came back. They piled on. They poured all of their efforts into getting the word out, and the 1930s was called the Red Decade. Now, there's no reason why the next decade and the next decades after that can't be our decades if we pull together, pile on, build up our infrastructure, and get the word out that there is another alternative to the whole false left-right dichotomy, and that the solution to the economic problem is not new thinking like the old, like the New Deal, other things like that. We really need to look at things from a fresh racial nationalist perspective.
That's Winston, a final question for Greg before we get some contact information.
I'm sorry, you're talking to me, James?
Yeah,
okay.
I know it's been a while. I was just asking if you had a final question for Dr. Johnson before we got some contact information and a plug for TOQ.
Yeah, I do have a question for him, but before I ask the question, I do want to ask Greg that when he finishes answering my question, if he would talk about the essay contest that the Occidental Quarterly is sponsoring. And my question is this, Greg. I'd like to refocus on what we were talking about earlier. There's an old joke about Hillary Clinton standing before the judgment throne of God and declaring to the Lord, I believe you're in my seat. Our enemies are motivated by their belief that this world is theirs and that they alone are the rightful owners, and everyone who disagrees with them are some kind of imposters. And they see it as their job to reclaim that with which these imposters have absconded. How do we fight an enemy like that who is so convinced of their own ownership of this world and our lives? How do we fight someone like that?
Well, first of all, anybody who says something like that really is, you really have to question their sanity, because that's a rather grandiose and absurd claim. I'm sure insane asylums are filled with people who think they're Napoleon, and they probably can sit down at the finger painting class with other lunatics who believe that they are the true rulers of the world. There's something nutty and crazy about it to begin with, and maybe the first reaction to that is just to laugh, just to mock that, and say, get thee to a loony bin. But beyond that, I have to admire on some level the grandiosity of that, because nothing great ever happens that it hasn't first been dreamed up by somebody. And the greatest things that happen are the product of the most grandiose dreams. And if you want to talk about world rulership and things like that, there is one group of people who really can make a claim to world rulership that isn't grandiose and absurd, and that's white people. 100 years or so ago, whites ruled practically the entire globe. We didn't claim that it was our birthright or anything, or that it really belonged to us, but we had this spirit of adventure, a bit of avarice, a bit of curiosity, the desire to see what was over the next horizon and so forth. And because we had superior technology and social organization and got there first a lot of times, practically the whole world fell into our hands. Now, my own inclination is not to think that we need to rule the world and tell other people what to do with their lives. But it is an amazing thing to contemplate that 100 years or so ago, white people ruled practically the entire globe, and 100 years later today, we are threatened with losing possession of our own homelands, not just places like the United States and Canada and Australia, but our European homelands, where we are the aboriginal peoples. There's nobody else who has any claim on those lands but us, and yet if present trends continue, we will lose control of our homelands, and eventually we might just be one of those extinct species like the dodo. So that is something extraordinary to contemplate. But what do we do to avoid this? Well, maybe we need to be grandiose. Maybe we need to promise ourselves the world again and go out and get it. But at least what we should do is promise ourselves our own homelands. Promise ourselves that we're going to be able to have a Europe that's for Europeans and an America for Americans and a Canada for Canadians. And by Americans and the Canadians, I mean white people. And we can do that again. White people were a tiny minority on this continent 400 years ago when Jamestown was founded, and yet we took the whole thing. And even if we become a minority in the next generation, there's no reason to think we can't take it all back. So those are just a few thoughts that I have.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you've enjoyed Greg Johnson's comments tonight throughout the course of this interview, if you found them provocative and you want to learn more, Greg, let folks know how they can learn more and read more through your writings and the writings of other leaders at the Occidental Quarterly. How can they subscribe?
Okay, well, if you have access to the Internet, go to theoccidentalquarterly.com. It's a long URL, but it's theoccidentalquarterly.com, all one word, lowercase, and you can find subscription information there. If you have a pen handy and you want to jot down our mailing address, again, it's the Occidental Quarterly, and it's Post Office Box 8127, Atlanta, Georgia, that's GA, 31106. Again, P.O. Box 8127, Atlanta, Georgia, 31106.
Well, folks, and also if you can't recall all of that, if you didn't have a pen handy while you're driving around in your car tonight or listening at home, just go to our website. I know you have it bookmarked, and it's probably your homepage, thepoliticalcesspool.org. It should be anyway. We have a great link prominently featured front and center on our homepage, thepoliticalcesspool.org, linking over to theoccidentalquarterly.com. Greg, we're flat out of time. I wish we had more. There was much more I wanted to get to. We'll have to make a return engagement for you on this program, and I want to let you know, and I mean this, and I don't say this after every show. We've had a lot of great guests, but I've enjoyed this interview immensely. I think it's among the highest caliber we've ever broadcast, and I want to thank you for making that happen.
Well, James, thank you very much. I'd be honored to come back, and I hope we can make that happen very soon. Thank you so much.
Greg Johnson, everyone, thank you for spending some time with us this evening, Greg, your Saturday night. Winston, absolutely outstanding interview, and folks, we still got an hour to go. Attorney Edgar J. Steele, Esquire, coming up next to talk about the abominable Missouri MIAC report. You've probably read about it if you've been to any conservative websites over the course of the past 2 weeks. We're going to find out what it's all about from Ed Steele, who's been talking about it also, when the Political Cesspool returns tonight on the Liberty News Radio Network. Well, we got a little bit more time to kill, apparently. That being said, yeah, check out, I'm telling you, I'm a little off tonight. It's just been one of those days. What can I say? Hey, we're all human, right? Well, we will be back, nevertheless, with Edgar J. Steele, and we know you're all looking forward to that. James Edwards Winston Smith in studio with you. AM 1380 WLRM Radio, the national news coming up next, 6 minutes of it, and then we'll be back with more.
Of the political cesspool coming your way right after these messages.
They call the rising sun.